Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, one and all. You've reached Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. I'm Dawn Davenport, your intrepid host. I'm also the author of The Complete Book of International Adoption, a step-by-step guide to finding your child. This book was published by Random House. I also have a website that focuses on infertility and all forms of adoption. The book is related exclusively to international adoption, but the website is for all forms of adoption as well, of course, as infertility. I have I have a blog on the website on adoptive parenting, and you can check it out by clicking on blog. This show is live every Wednesday from 12 to 1 Eastern Time. You can call in at 347-215 8510 with your questions, or you can email them to me at dawn@findingyourchild.com. I'll take your call as soon as we finish our train of thought, so you may have to wait on hold for just a few minutes. On today's show, I will be interviewing Dr. Walter Willett. He's both an MD and a PhD, and he's the co-author of a new book called The Fertility Diet. He's also the chairman of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health, and he's a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He is one of the leaders of the influential Nurses Health Study, and he's also the author of a previous book called Eat, Drink, and Be Healthy, The Harvard Medical School Guide to Healthy Eating. On today's show, we're going to talk about the dietary and lifestyle choices that can increase your chances of getting pregnant. Welcome, Dr. Willett, to Creating a Family.
Glad to be with you.
This book and the study that it was based on was based on the Nurses Health Study, and this is an absolutely fascinating longitudinal study which surveys, I guess, tens of thousands of female nurses. Would it be fair to say that this study alone, the Nurses Health Study, has more or less rewritten what we know about how diet and lifestyle affect disease, particularly disease in women?
I think that's probably true. We have over 200,000 registered nurses across the country who have been participating since 1976, and we really owe it to these participants. After 30 years, more than 90% are still sending back questionnaires, and what they've contributed to knowledge is enormous.
Yeah, and it's just, it's not just infertility. It goes, much of what we know, and I think our listeners probably aren't aware of it, but so much of what we take as common wisdom nowadays on diet and lifestyle did come from this study. And you were one of the founders of the study, were you not? Or one of the the second part of the study you were a founder of, is that correct?
Right. I joined in 1977 when it was just getting up and started. So
yeah.
Been with it for quite a while.
Yeah.
And like you say, a lot of the things we take for granted weren't even appreciated at that time. In 1976, for example, it was thought that smoking did not influence heart disease risk in women. It was just in men. And, of course, we now know it's the number one cause of heart disease in women.
Right. Yeah, things that we think of now as common sense weren't so common or so commonsensical back then. In this study, you found that approximately 13% of the women the nurses who participated in the study had difficulty becoming pregnant. And that more or less correlates with the CDC statistics of about 10%. Is the difference in any way significant?
No, it's not. It's probably because it's a small difference to begin with, but on average, women in the Nurses' Health Study were a little bit older than the average woman and trying to become pregnant at a time when fertility is tapering off.
So that makes sense, and they were professional women, and they may well have postponed until they got their careers established. So you're right, that makes good sense. I should point out that the information in this the book, The Fertility Diet, is specifically related to ovulation-related infertility, although there's a lot of good evidence and speculation that the information would apply to all forms of infertility. And in the book, you list 10 things, that 10 dietary changes or lifestyle changes, that women and men, and that's very important to note that, and I'll try to remember every time we talk about one to ask about whether this one applies to the men in our lives as well, because as we all know, infertility is not just a women's issue. And
that's right.
I thought what we would start with is I'm going to read the 10 just because I want to make sure that we don't omit any of them when we get busy and continue to talk. So bear with me here and let me just quickly read them, and then we're going to talk about each of them and most of the more controversial ones. One, avoid trans fats. We hear that a lot. Two, use more unsaturated vegetable oils such as olive oil or canola oil. Three, eat more vegetable proteins like beans and nuts. and more importantly, get less of your proteins from animal sources. 4, choose more whole grains and other sources of carbohydrates for your diet. 5, drink a glass of whole milk or, I think actually you were just saying, switch to whole milk dairy products. 6, take a multivitamin that contains folic acid as well as other B vitamins. 7, get plenty of iron, either from your diet as well as from a supplement. 8, we're going to talk about the impact of coffee, tea, and alcohol. 9, aim for a healthy weight. And 10, start exercising. And we should throw in number 11, if you smoke, stop. That seems, again, intuitive, but and that actually wasn't shown up in the study, but I think that was primarily because not many of the nurses smoked. So
that's right.
Anyway, you know, before we talk about each of the 10, I wanted to talk about one of the criticisms that I hear of this book is that some women feel like it undermines the perception that infertility is a disease, and it gives ammunition to the old just relax line, and now it'll be just have a bowl of ice cream and boom, you'll have a baby. I hear their frustration, but yet when I read the book, I don't think that that's what you're saying at all.
No, not at all. And in fact, 9 out of the 10 points fit very much with what we know about being healthy in general to prevent diabetes, heart disease, and some cancers. And that's not too surprising because it would be really surprising if what was healthy for the heart and the endocrine system was not healthy for the reproductive system.
Right.
As well.
That truly would be counterintuitive.
Yes, right. And the one, it's maybe why some people focused on it a little bit, the one thing that does seem to be out of line is the whole fat dairy products, milk and ice cream.
Yeah, you're right. That's an interesting one, and I do want to talk about that. You do say, in fact, that and it flies in the face of what we're hearing the latest dietary guidelines issued by the government, which is focusing on skim or low fat dairy products, and actually a greater number of those servings. What you're recommending is 1 to 2 servings of whole milk or whole milk dairy product a day.
Yes, that's right. And this is something that seems really weird and out of the blue, and it's something we're not 100% sure of. The reality is nobody else has studied this, and actually nobody else really has the population set up to look at this and see if it's a reproducible finding. It would be nice if we could quickly test this in other populations. But it's not an isolated finding because we've published 2 other papers looking at food consumption and acne in adolescents. And in both of those studies, whole fat milk as opposed to low fat milk seemed to be beneficial.
And I know that absolutely astounds me. I mean, because you think acne, you think it's, you know, the overproduction of oil, therefore consumption of more fatty product it seems, why is that? And what does acne have to do with getting pregnant?
Well, we're not 100% sure, but we have some hypotheses. And acne is actually very closely related to fertility, by the way, because it is one of the major signs of the polycystic ovary syndrome.
Yes, and we will talk about that. Before we end, I'm going to specifically talk about that because I know I have a lot of listeners who suffer from PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Right.
But go ahead.
Our hypothesis is that what we do know is that the estrogens and the progestins in milk actually travel in the fat component of milk. So when you remove the fat, you're removing the sort of female component of milk in some sense, that the female hormones, estrogens and progestins are taken away when you skim off the fat.
Wouldn't you also be taking off any of the male testosterone? But I suppose because it's coming from a female cow, that there isn't a lot.
Right. There's some there, but not a lot. And we do know that the polycystic ovary syndrome, and that's sort of the model of the most advanced stage of ovulatory infertility, in that condition, the testosterone in the blood is very high. And, in fact, that's part of the diagnosis is measuring blood testosterone levels. So it may well be that the estrogens and progestins in milk are, to some extent, counterbalancing that overly male hormonal pattern.
Could you just outline just a few of the symptoms for PCOS so that I will go ahead and talk about it now, because all of the dietary and lifestyle changes that we're going to be talking about are directly applicable to polycystic ovarian syndrome. Because as you point out, it's the ultimate in the line of ovulation-related infertility.
Right. So part of the symptoms are irregular menstrual cycles and infertility, also excessive body hair, often on the face, and acne. On average, people with the polycystic ovarian syndrome weigh more, but there are some lean people who have it as well. And so that, along with the infertility, is usually how it's recognized. And then oftentimes a blood test is done, and again, testosterone is high. And underlying it, really at the sort of the metabolic center of this syndrome, is insulin resistance.
One of the things that we read a lot about is a concern for the hormones in dairy products. And I had assumed that the concern was towards estrogen, but you're saying that, in fact, that would be a good thing for us to be getting from our milk.
Well, it might be a good thing if you're trying to get pregnant. If you're concerned about breast cancer throughout life, that might not be a good thing. And particularly that combination of estrogen plus progestin, we've learned from a breast cancer standpoint at high levels, those are not good. So when we discuss this in the book, we don't recommend going on a lifetime diet of high-fat dairy products. But for this period, if women are having some trouble becoming pregnant, for a short time here, and in fact it's an age when heart disease risk is really not on the horizon, then for a short time, I think it's reasonable to try that along with the other things, but certainly not in isolation.
Not in isolation. And does this advice hold true for men as well, drinking a couple of glasses of whole milk a day?
We actually don't have any data on that. And this study within the Nurses' Health study was really the first detailed look at diet and infertility at all. And it's been a hugely neglected area. It was Dr. Shavaro's idea, my co-author of this book, while he was a student, to take on this issue. And so this is really cutting into unexplored territory. And Dr. Shavaro right now has actually started some studies to look at some of these issues in men. But for the most part, we have very little data on men up till now.
Yeah, well, I think that the men's contribution to infertility in general tends to be overlooked. One of the things that you mentioned in the book, or you recommend in the book, is to get more of your protein from plants and fish. And specifically, you mentioned farm-raised salmon. Well, my ears and eyes certainly perked up because I thought we were supposed to be limiting our consumption of farm-raised salmon to, I think, something along the lines of once a month because of the PCB contamination, or the concern for PCB contamination found in the farm-raised salmon, and I assume that that comes from the fish feed that was used in the farms. So what is the? Were you not finding PCB contamination in the farm-raised salmon?
Well, people have. There was a paper that received a lot of press, probably overly, that generated probably exaggerated concern. And it's complicated. In today's world, there's hardly a place you can go anywhere in the world and find foods that don't have some small degree of contamination.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, it's perhaps a sad commentary, but that's the reality. So the probably what's received even more attention, and I think where there is better evidence to be concerned about, is mercury in fish. For adults, I don't think it's really much of a problem, but again, for women thinking of becoming pregnant or lactating, that's the particular period in life when it is prudent to try to keep mercury low. So salmon has rather low level, quite very low levels of mercury, actually, now whether it's farm-raised or wild, and particularly very, very low in farm-raised salmon. So from a mercury standpoint, it's really good. From the PCB and other organic chemicals, those were in this report were actually present in very low amounts, and there was no direct evidence of human harm. Theoretical calculations showed a very low risk of cancer, and even then, since that time, there's been more attention paid to the feed source of the salmon. There's more of an issue in salmon that are produced in the Baltic Sea, where there's much more intense contamination in there. So it's one of these things where it's prudent to keep the levels as low as possible, but the reality is if you go for zero, you're not going to eat anything.
So for a woman who is attempting to get pregnant or may be pregnant, What fish do you recommend? Farm-raised salmon is number one on the list because of the mercury issue. Any others that you would steer her towards?
Well, I think eating a variety of fish is a good idea, and there are a few that are best to be avoided during that period of time. There's swordfish, tilefish, shark, and tuna fish. Those are particularly high in mercury. So I'd avoid those, but having a variety of other fish is a good thing to do. Actually, small fish like smelt are really very good. They're low on the food chain and rich in omega-3 fatty acids, which is one of the reasons to eat fish. Definitely women should be eating fish if they're thinking of becoming pregnant or pregnant, because we actually have to have those omega-3 fatty acids to build a healthy fetus. If someone is not consuming fish at all, they should be taking a fish oil supplement.
And now we get to, as I was sitting here talking with you, sipping on my coffee, I thought we would move into talking about coffee and tea. And I found a couple of things very interesting. First of all, you make a distinction between caffeine that comes from coffee or tea and caffeine that comes from soda. Is it the caffeine in the soda that's a problem, or is it all the other junk that's in the soda?
It looks like it's probably the high sugar content in soda that's an issue, because we actually didn't see that overall caffeine intake, and there's plenty more caffeine from coffee and tea than from soda. Even overall caffeine intake in this population was not related to infertility. This is one topic that has been looked at in several studies. A few studies suggested a small increase in infertility, others haven't. So I think there's the jury's out whether there's no adverse effect or a small benefit. Interestingly, for type 2 diabetes, coffee consumption reduces the risk. There's now a really massive literature.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, so it's possible that there's some good effects of coffee and some bad effects, and they seem to be more or less balancing them off from the standpoint of fertility.
And is tea considered better or higher in any of the antioxidants or the micronutrients than coffee, or do they just have different micronutrients and antioxidants?
They have different. Actually, coffee is a very potent brew of antioxidants. It's in our overall diet, coffee is the number one source of antioxidants, surprisingly.
Wow, I didn't know that. I thought blueberries were where I was supposed to be focusing, and kale.
Well, if we had 4 cups of blueberries a day, we probably would.
I can't afford 4 cups of blueberries a day.
I would like to have them too, but same problem.
Yeah, so from the standpoint, as far as, I mean, the ultimate object of trying to get pregnant is being pregnant. So caffeine in pregnancy, I know that some women are concerned that if they're going to avoid it if they're pregnant, that they should be avoiding it going into pregnancy. What are the latest studies, or this is not really pertaining directly to the book, but what are the latest studies as far as caffeine in pregnancy, while you're pregnant?
Right. There have been concerns about abortion and birth weight. And the literature is, again, mixed, not totally clear on that, but there is enough concern. I think it's probably prudent to either avoid caffeine during pregnancy or keep the intake very low.
So once you find out that you are pregnant, at that point, follow your doctor's suggestions, but probably she or he will be recommending avoidance of caffeine.
That's right.
Yeah. And now let's talk about alcohol. It seems like the alcohol consumption or the data related to alcohol consumption and fertility, or pregnancy actually, well, more so pre-pregnancy, is all over the board. So what do you recommend?
Well, we did look at this, and we did not find an adverse effect of alcohol on pregnancy. Again, too much in big bouts of course is a common cause of pregnancy, but
yes.
Right. But the moderate amounts that women were usually consuming in our study population did not seem to be related to one way or another to pregnancy. And alcohol, as you are well aware, is very complex because there are some benefits. It does reduce heart disease. It does reduce risk of type 2 diabetes, probably by reducing insulin resistance somewhat. So there may be some good effects and bad effects. We saw it overall to be pretty neutral in moderation, up to one, maybe two drinks a day in terms of pregnancy. I think, again, it's pretty much like coffee. From what we've seen, if someone's having one drink a day, it doesn't seem to adversely affect fertility. But during pregnancy, and even at that level, it's really been hard to say there's adverse effects during pregnancy, but most women are advised to not consume alcohol during pregnancy, just, again, being ultra-cautious.
Yeah, and I think if you can make a distinction, or it seems easy enough for me to make a distinction in my mind between someone who is trying to get pregnant and somebody who is pregnant.
Right.
It seems like so much of the research out there on alcohol consumption is somewhat clouded by the concern, it seems to me, the concern of researchers, or fear from researchers of recommending alcohol because of the concern that somebody will not do it in moderation, and alcoholism and it's such a devastating disease. But yet much of what I'm reading is saying that moderate alcohol consumption is generally, on the whole, a better thing for you than a harmful thing for you.
Yes, although that does depend on the time of life cycle as well, because it does reduce heart disease risk. The evidence is unequivocal for that, and very strong evidence in modestly lowering risk of type 2 diabetes as well. But for heart disease, it's not going to be beneficial if you're really not at risk of heart disease. And so women in the reproductive age generally have very low risk of coronary heart disease.
Right, yeah.
So in some ways, there's not too much to prevent, and there are some harms. So
there's huge harm if you're pregnant. I mean, the
right.
Potential is for huge harm, particularly if you're not drinking in moderation.
Absolutely. So the risks and benefits really do in women under 50 weigh more on the side of adverse consequences. Again, if someone keeps it in moderation and doesn't drink too much, then it's pretty much going to be neutral.
Okay, you're listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. The call-in number today is 347-215-8510. And today we're talking with Dr. Walter Willett. He is the co-author of The Fertility Diet, and he's also the chairperson of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Let's move on to the discussion of weight. Weight is a huge issue for many people, not just, of course, people who are trying to conceive, and yet it does affect fertility. In what way is excess weight a problem for someone trying to conceive?
Yes, it is a common problem and a very real one. Up until fairly recently, we were almost always focusing on the low end, and we've known for a long time, for example, that ballet dancers and competitive athletes who are very lean, exercising intensively, develop amenorrhea, and of course are infertile. But those people are rare in contemporary America. And we have most of the population, adult population, is actually overweight or obese. And we've seen that the likelihood of infertility starts to increase even at the upper part of what's called the normal range, even by a BMI of 25, which is the upper part of the normal range of body fatness, we can see a significant increase in infertility. And then as the weight goes up more and more, the likelihood of infertility continues to mount. So it looks like the optimal BMI is between about 20 and 24, and we've called that the fertility window.
Let me just give some numbers so people, I want to make that real to people. There is, in the Fertility Diet book, there is a BMI chart. You can also, of course, get it online anywhere else. But for instance, the BMI range that Dr. Willett just mentioned from 20 to 24, if you are 5'6", that would be approximately 124 pounds to 148 pounds. If you are 5'3", that would be 113 to 135 pounds. 5'9", let's say 5'8", would be 131 to 158. I think that makes it a little more real for people listening to know about what type of range, and that's women, I think.
That's helpful, yes.
Yeah. Go ahead, though. So that's the range that people should be aiming for optimum fertility?
Right. Now, if someone has a BMI way out of range, above 30, for example, it's really difficult to get it all the way back to a BMI of 24. Some people can do it, and if you can, that's really great. But women shouldn't be discouraged if they can't get all the way back there. If they can lose about even 5% or 10% of their weight, that can often make a big difference in their likelihood of becoming fertile.
And you say that in the book, you say that to stop gaining weight, it's as simple as cutting out 100 calories a day, but assuming you are overweight and you want to jumpstart your ovulation, you recommend cutting back about 250 calories a day.
Yes, that's a good aim to go for. We don't suggest radical crash diets. Those are usually not sustainable and not healthy either. So this moderate reduction in calories is a good way to do that. If you're having just a 12-ounce can of soda a day, that's about 150 calories right there.
And nobody has 12-ounce anymore. They're all 16-ounce. You almost can't find a can,
yeah,
which is a 12-ounce, I believe it. But the plastic the plastic containers that they normally sell, I'm sure it's at least 16 ounces.
Right. They actually are, usually if you look carefully, they are 2 servings of 8 ounces.
Right. Big joke there.
But that's in very fine print, so you're absolutely right. So that cutting out that, just one of those per day is going to, actually that's enough calories to cut back right there and experience weight loss if you don't add it back somewhere else in your diet. But people find it often very easy to cut out the liquid calories. Partly they're a problem because you can add them on so easily, but it also means that they're easier to get rid of.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like you're giving up as much unless you are a person who actually just really craves that. What about the different approaches to diet? I mean, does it really matter from a fertility standpoint whether you go the high-protein, low-carb approach or the low-fat approach or the Mediterranean diet approach or whatever the latest fad is?
From the standpoint of directly weight itself, it may not matter. But when we look at the other aspects of diet that influence fertility, something closer to the Mediterranean approach looks like it's going to be better because we do see that high intake of red meat, which would be part of some of the older Atkins type diets, that high consumption of red meat was related to more infertility, not less infertility, and that healthy vegetable oils compared to trans fat and saturated fat appear to be related to better fertility. So again, it's I think we want to look at the overall diet and its influence on fertility, but also not just fertility. Women should be as healthy as possible overall if they're thinking about pregnancy, and also we need to think about the women's a diet that will help reduce the risk of gestational diabetes, which is not good for the woman, not good for the fetus,
mm-hmm.
And also about a dietary pattern. This is a good time to think about a lifetime dietary pattern because it's not just pregnancy. You want to be healthy and well to take care of the child and to see your grandchildren and enjoy them as well.
What about weight loss medication, either prescription or the new over-the-counter? Is it Ali, I think it's called.
Right. In general, those have quite modest benefits. And I'd use those as a last resort and in conjunction with counseling by one's own private health, one's own healthcare provider. I think, again, the most important thing is to establish a way of eating that will be of benefit for not just becoming pregnant but throughout the pregnancy as well. And I don't think most of those drugs have been studied with regard to influences while a woman is pregnant.
Yeah, that was my next question, is how that would, after she conceives, what it would do. We have an email question from Laura. She says that she is obese and infertile. She is considering gastric bypass surgery and wants to know if that would be effective, both for weight loss and whether the weight loss associated with gastric bypass would potentially help her conceive. And then her second part of her question asks about gastric bypass surgery's impact on pregnancy.
Right. Almost surely that the weight loss from a gastric bypass would help a woman conceive. Might be the right choice for this person. One would obviously want to know in detail about the past family history, about background attempts to control weight by diet and physical activity. Some people will not be able to control their weight in other ways, and the bypass may be the right choice for them. I think, though, that that should apply to quite a small fraction of the population, and it is really important to give good diet and physical activity pattern a thorough try before moving on to something like that, because the good diet and lifestyle has so many impacts, so many benefits apart from the direct benefits on weight. And even if one is going to have a surgery to lose weight, it's still extremely important to pay attention to the diet and physical activity aspects.
Have you seen any research on the percentage of people who regain the weight even after having the gastric bypass?
Well, a large percentage of people do regain some of the weight, but there is a clear benefit of that most people don't regain all of the weight. But I think, again, this is when people do lose some weight, it's a window of opportunity to work really hard to build physical activity and diet into daily life to avoid that weight regain. Because once somebody is severely overweight, exercise becomes very difficult. So everyone should be counseled to take full advantage of that opportunity.
And how many people, there probably isn't research on this, but actually do make, is once you start losing the weight, if the gastric bypass or the banding or whatever the procedure your doctor recommends jump starts the process, is the hope then that it will become easier to eat healthy, or do people then just eat smaller quantities of the same lousy food they had been eating before?
Well, I'm afraid that in many situations, not enough attention is given to the diet and lifestyle aspects, and people do continue to eat the same awful food that they were usually eating before. Not everybody, but the average American is eating pretty awful food to begin with. And it's very clear that just the bypass alone, there is almost everybody does regain some weight. There is some clear benefit, but the best approach is to not make it either or.
To do it, if you do the, to make the lifestyle change as well, even if you do the surgery.
Absolutely.
I have read nothing about this, but the impact on a pregnancy once you've had any form of weight reduction surgery.
I haven't seen any data on that, but from everything we know about the metabolic process, it will reduce insulin resistance. Again, it's the core of the ovulatory infertility problems, and almost for sure there will be some benefit in terms of likelihood of becoming pregnant.
But once pregnant, I think that's her question, once pregnant, it seems to me that if you are cautious and careful of what you're putting in the smaller stomach, that you can still gain the question, can you get enough nutrients in to support a pregnancy?
Yes, that shouldn't be a problem. One should work very carefully with your healthcare provider. This is likely to be an exception. Usually we tell women to gain so much weight during pregnancy, it may be appropriate not to gain any weight during pregnancy if you're in a sort of downward slope after gastric bypass surgery. So that's something that needs to be consider very carefully with one's healthcare provider.
Here is an email from Rhonda. She says she has not read the book, but read the article in Newsweek, and it seemed to her that this was just another excuse to blame women for their infertility, along the lines of, if you would only eat right and exercise, you wouldn't be infertile. Do you have any comment on that?
That's certainly not the intent. The intent here is to empower women to enable them to become pregnant if they haven't been able to, and provide them with the information that can improve their likelihood. This is no guarantee, and certainly if a group of people followed exactly what we've said here, not 100% would become pregnant, even if they all had ovulatory infertility to begin with. There's almost nothing in life that's 100% or zero. So, but we do find that it looks like about two-thirds of the cases of ovulatory infertility could be avoided by this combination of diet and lifestyle. So some of these, of course, there is a misconception that that personal responsibility is everything in diet and lifestyle. Clearly, people do need to take responsibility at some level for their choices, but oftentimes people are living in circumstances where the system is stacked against them for adopting a good diet and lifestyle. And in particular, we've really allowed our children to be exploited by aggressive advertising that conditions them to eating a terrible diet and drinking horrible beverages.
Well, it's not just it's in the schools. It's you go to a restaurant and you get a soda, and they immediately come, or your child gets a soda, and they immediately come and refill it. You know, it's pervasive. And let me make a comment to Rhonda. I've read both the Newsweek article as well as the book, The Fertility Diet, and I would strongly encourage you, Rhonda, to read the book. I don't get the feel at all in reading the book that not only is it not the intent of the book to say that, number one, all infertility is caused by diet, or that it's a woman's fault that she's infertile. It's not the intent of the book, and I don't think that the book says that. I don't think it implies that at all. So I would encourage you to don't rely just on excerpts. Actually, read the whole thing and then judge for yourself. We talked about, or you talk in the book about the benefits of exercise, and as opposed to some of what we read, which says, you know, moderate exercise or, you know, even low-level exercise is good, you're encouraging, you're saying that the better benefit, the greater benefit comes with vigorous exercise. And what do you mean by vigorous exercise?
Yes, that definitely moderate exercise, like walking, is very good. But it looks like there are some extra benefits in terms of fertility and for health in general of more intensive exercise, the kind of exercise where you really do breathe deeply and sweat. And that might be jogging. That's the most common way that people get vigorous physical activity. It might be bicycle riding, but sort of faster bicycle riding, not just slowly drifting along. It might be swimming, but really doing laps, not just sort of floating around in the water. And we do see that that does produce a better level of physiological fitness, better reducing heart disease risk. But still, I don't want people to be discouraged if they can't do that level for one reason or another. Even the moderate walking a couple of miles a day still has very important benefits. So
this is a question we just got from, just came in from Lane. She says, I hate to exercise. Can I see some improvement with just walking? So that leads right into what you were saying.
Right, definitely. But it is important to walk briskly. And if somebody's really out of shape, they may even have trouble doing that. But so in building up exercise, it's one should do it gradually. Walking at a slower pace, if that's what you're used to doing, going a little farther, building up on the speed a little bit, step by step. That's very important to do. And again, I'd like to emphasize that in some sense, polycystic ovary syndrome and this sort of polycystic ovarian syndrome with infertility that we're talking about, for many people, this is a little bit of a warning flag that your diet and lifestyle is out of balance, and fertility is one of the manifestations, but it's a time to re-examine what we're eating, our level of activity, because this will relate to our well-being throughout the rest of our life.
And in the book, you talk about balancing, and I thought this was a very wise way to think about it. It's common sense, but it helped to hear it, that with exercise, you're really trying to balance intensity, duration, and frequency. So if, for instance, you are choosing to walk rather than run because you prefer it, or you'll do it, you like it better, whatever, or it's all you can do, you might want to walk further. You might want to try to do a mile rather than a half a mile, or and up it to 2 miles. And rather than do it 3 times a week, you might say, if I'm going to walk, I'm going to walk 5 days a week, so that you're increasing your frequency and your duration, because you don't care to increase your intensity. Would that apply to other exercises as well?
Yeah, absolutely right. And there is some trade-off here. For people who are really busy, myself, I find that in 25, 30 minutes, if I run, I can get the equivalent benefit of an hour of walking, and I would really have a hard time finding that hour of walking. So a lot of people have found ways to fit smaller amounts or shorter durations of more intense physical activity, but that's not for everybody. And the examples you gave of somebody going from 1 mile to 2 miles, a day. And the really important thing is to find a way to do it that gives you positive feedback. It may be that with friends, it may be finding the right place to do it, a pleasant place to walk. Some people like to go to fitness clubs, the group aspect of it, it gives support. There's a thousand different ways of doing it, and the really key thing is to find a way that makes you feel better and that you enjoy, so you continue it in one way or another for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and you give subtle suggestions, which I think it's important to think of. If you're going to go shopping, park as far away, not as close, and just make it a habit to always park as far away. Take the stairs whenever possible. That's increasingly hard to do. In new buildings, it's often hard to find the stairs, or you're concerned that you're going to get locked in if you try. But nonetheless, that's another idea. Walk around your office when you're thinking or talking on the phone. Anything along those lines, although that doesn't fit obviously into vigorous, it does fit into the just increasing your body movement.
Right. That I think exactly. Too. We want to encourage people to think creatively and find some ideas that we haven't even thought of.
Yeah. You're listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. And today I'm talking with Dr. Walter Willett. He is one of the co-authors of a new book, The Fertility Diet. And the book is based on research done, longitudinal research based on a large number of female nurses, the Nurses Health Survey, linking dietary and lifestyle changes to increased fertility. One of the things you recommend is a multivitamin. I'm used to hearing that we're supposed to be getting most of our nutrition from our food and not relying on supplements. So why do you recommend a multivitamin?
Well, we did find that women in our study who took a multivitamin had about a 40% lower likelihood of having infertility compared to women who are not taking multiple vitamins. We're not exactly sure what it is that is doing that, but this is not an isolated finding. For example, veterinary medicine has shown that giving folic acid to pigs increases the number of pigs in a litter. There's some animal research here, and actually there's a lot more research that's been done in animal fertility than in human fertility because of the economic implications there. But there was also a really interesting and important study done in Europe a few years ago where they gave a multiple vitamin in a randomized double-blind trial to look at prevention of birth defects. And I think you're probably aware the study was stopped early because there was an important benefit for prevention of birth defects.
Yes.
But buried in the study was the finding that one of the unexpected effects was more twins in the women who were given the active multiple vitamin. So that's, I think, an important message that just to keep in mind that fertility is a continuum. You have zero, or you can have one, or you can have more than one. And we know that from a lot of the fertility drugs. The main side effect is twins.
Mm-hmm. Or higher order multiples,
right?
The drugs.
Right. So that it looks like even the plain old multiple vitamin is you know, certainly milder than those drugs, but can operate from zero to one and from one to more than one.
Well, why not try to get your folic acid from food rather than supplements?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's possible that if someone really has an ideal diet, that the supplement might not do anything, might not add any further benefit. But we're not sure of that. And we're not exactly sure whether it's the folic acid or some combination of the other ingredients of a multiple vitamin. And one other point where you cannot get enough from your regular diet is vitamin D. And we're finding that that's a very pervasive problem, inadequate vitamin D, especially women living in the northern United States. But we've been so taught to avoid sun because of skin cancer risk that, and we live inside, put on clothes, and avoid sun, we're finding that the average American has very suboptimal levels of blood vitamin D. And there's no good food source except for fish, and even in fish, the amounts are rather small. There's no natural food source. There's some vitamin D in milk, which is almost always fortified now, but even that is rather a modest amount of vitamin D.
Does it take much sunlight, though, to get the vitamin D just from the sun itself?
Well, it's possible to, it's certainly possible to get plenty. In fact, if you go out on a bright sunny day in the middle of the summer, expose most of your skin, in half an hour you will make about 15,000 or 20,000 international units of vitamin D, and the RDA is only 400, so this is really big dose you can make naturally. But the reality is that the majority of people in the United States are not getting that level of sun exposure or anything close to it. And it's if you're very careful and you expose your sun skin only maybe about 15 minutes, you will probably not appreciably increase your skin risk of skin cancer. But it's really hard for most of us. I know I just can't work it out to, during the middle of the day, go out, expose most of my skin for 15 minutes on each side. You know, it's pretty hard to do that.
So it's not just a matter of, you know, taking off your coat and letting your arms, and wear a short sleeve, so your arms, it actually is a significant, you need to expose more skin, and you need to do it for longer than just a walk in from the car to the building type of thing.
Right, and the problem is if we're just trying to use, say, our arms, the dose of vitamin D, or dose of ultraviolet radiation we have to get to make enough vitamin D, that would be enough to increase the risk of skin cancer. So exposing most of your skin is that you're spreading around the exposure to ultraviolet, so at any one point there's not going to be a burn or damage there. If we concentrate the exposure and try to get all our adequate vitamin D, then we're into the skin cancer risk area if it's just a small part of our skin.
You know, you get the feeling sometimes that you're damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Yeah, it's sometimes it's there are trade-offs, and
sometimes
it's complicated.
It's all an issue of moderation, it seems to me, on some level. Were you surprised by the results that the source of the iron made a difference in the impact on fertility? I guess I should mention that you also recommend making certain that you get a certain amount of iron, but then you take it further and say that the source of the iron, was that a surprising result?
Not too much. Actually, we've seen that high intake of iron from red meat, and specifically the heme iron, has been related to risk of diabetes. One of the problems getting the iron from red meat is that the heme iron, the form of iron in red meat, continues to be absorbed by the body even if we have plenty of iron already. And that can lead to overload and damage to the pancreas and type 2 diabetes. So the form of iron, the inorganic form of iron that we get from vegetables and grains and supplements, is regulated. So if we have enough iron, we almost completely shut down our absorption of it, and then thereby we don't overload ourselves with iron.
I know we're going to talk about supplements in just a minute, but where in your diet, what type of grains and vegetables are high in iron? You don't think of grain and vegetable sources for iron.
Well, the best sources are the green leafy vegetables, kale, spinach, broccoli. Those are actually very good sources of iron. And there's small amounts in whole grains and some other foods, but those green leafy vegetables are going to be the best source.
And we have an email from Randy. She says, what brand of vitamin do you recommend, and how much folic acid, iron, and vitamin D do you recommend for pre-pregnancy planning?
Yes, I don't recommend any specific brands of multiple vitamins. There are multiple good sources out there. What I would look for, and in terms of amounts, in general, we're just talking about RDA levels here, not megavitamins. Mostly to make sure that we don't have really holes in our diet. But a lot of people, even thinking they're eating healthy diets, are short on some of the B vitamins, for example. But vitamin D is the one area that is a little bit of an exception. There, as I mentioned earlier, there's almost universal consensus among researchers working in the field that the RDA, which was set about 10 years ago, is way too low.
What is the RDA, and what do you recommend?
The RDA is 400 IUs, but it looks like to get blood levels up to where they should be, most people will require at least 2,000. Per day. But even that small, again, remember you can make 20,000 yourself out on a sunny day in half an hour. So it, by comparison, still 2,000 is rather small. And now physicians are much more commonly checking blood levels of vitamin D and finding that even many people on 2,000 I use are not up to the adequate blood level. So if you have question, and I think particularly if you're thinking about becoming pregnant, checking in with your healthcare provider is a really good thing to do, and just to make sure blood pressure is under control, your glucose is under control, and that you really want to be tuned up at going if you're thinking about becoming pregnant.
And what did you? I don't think you said what should you look for as far as folic acid and iron? Do you have an amount?
There for folic acid, just the RDA of which is 400.
400, gotcha.
20, right. And for iron, what we saw was that women who got actually about 40 milligrams a day, which is a little bit above the RDA, actually that's where we saw the greatest benefit. And the reality is that there's quite a high percentage of women who are premenopausal who are iron deficient, basically because of regular menstrual cycles. And often it's health-conscious women who have cut back on red meat, which is in general a good thing to do. But if you've got regular monthly losses and you're not getting a lot of iron from your diet, you can easily become iron deficient. It may not show up as anemia yet, but if you check the blood iron levels, many people are very low. So I think what we're seeing here is probably women are just, with the iron supplement, are filling in a gap that is a very common gap.
Now, again, we've been speaking of women, but if you are a couple who are experiencing infertility, does it make sense, or is there any data that supports that men's fertility is helped as well by either folic acid, iron, or vitamin D?
We really don't have any data, and Dr. Shavar, my colleague, is investigating that right at this time. We don't have a lot of data on women. This is really the first substantial study that's looked at fertility and nutrition in women, and in men, it's a missing piece, but I'm quite confident that we'll have in the next year or two some results for men.
Here's an email from Kim. She says, I have recently heard on TV that the old advice to drink 8 glasses of water a day no longer holds. I have read, though, that it helps with fertility. Is this true?
The general advice is probably not correct, and there has been some publicity about that. We, first of all, you can get fluid in other ways. Eating a lot of vegetables have a lot of fluid, and eating or getting your water along with food or as part of food is another way to do it. Tea and coffee, those do count as beverages and fluid as well. So I think that's the sort of the nuance. It doesn't have to be pure water, but pure water is a great source of water, in fact.
It's also a low-calorie source of
water. Right, low calories, inexpensive, so it is a very desirable source, and especially instead of sodas and sugary beverages, water is a huge, hugely desirable. But in terms of fertility, in fact, I'm not even sure if we've looked at just straight water consumption and fertility. We did see increased risk with soda and sugary beverages, so if you replace those with water, that will be a benefit in terms of fertility.
Here's another email from Stacy. Are there any advantages to a pure vegetarian diet for improving fertility?
I don't think inherently there is an advantage in terms of fertility. And if somebody's really on a strict vegetarian diet, you will become deficient in vitamin B12, and that can cause neurologic damage to the fetus. So, that's one thing that people who do want to be a vegetarian, I think it's perfectly fine. But if you do want to be a vegetarian, make sure that you get some supplement of vitamin B12 or a food that's fortified in vitamin B12. Interestingly, it looks like we weren't designed to live on an absolute vegan diet.
And she doesn't mention whether she's vegan or she's getting protein from or she's eating dairy products. She did not mention that. But if you're going to be a vegetarian, you're saying that it might make sense to not approach it from a vegan standpoint?
I think if it's okay to do so, but remember you've got to get B12 one way or another, and you won't get it on a really strict vegan diet.
Okay. Here's an email from Shana. What's the impact of soy products on fertility?
Really interesting question, and we didn't see anything with soy products in the amount that they were consumed within the nurses' health study, but we didn't have really very many women consuming large amounts of soy products, so we can't say anything about that. For men, it's a very interesting question. I know that's an issue that Dr. Shabrawa is looking at right now. In general, it's very interesting because soy products do contain phytoestrogens, and they're active compounds that under some circumstances can act like an estrogen and other circumstances act like an anti-estrogen. So exactly how they're working in the context of a premenopausal woman who's trying to conceive, we really don't know at the sort of high to medium levels.
Wouldn't common sense tell you that their infertility is not more rampant? I don't know. I wouldn't assume in countries that do consume large amounts of soy, and I think of the Asian countries in specific. So epidemiologically, wouldn't that indicate that if soy alone was going to either help or hurt, do we know whether they have greater or lesser amounts of infertility?
Well, we really don't.
Irrespective of age, I should add.
Right. Yeah. I think in general, your point is right that if it was really a big problem, there wouldn't be so many. We wouldn't have huge populations in Asia.
Right.
Parts of Asia, for example. But the context in which people have lived there is so different that in general, until very recently, they've been lean, highly active. Of course, that's changing very rapidly in many parts of Asia.
Yeah.
So in the American context, where people have put on a few pounds, they might have a little more insulin resistance for that reason and for being less physically active than in traditional lifestyles. If something tipped you one way or another sort of modestly, it could be having some impact, and we wouldn't detect it by this cross-country comparison. But I think you're basically right. If it was really a big problem, we would see it. Whether under some circumstances it might be beneficial is also a possibility.
And I believe I read somewhere in the book that subsequent studies were underway or planned to test whether if these suggestions in the book were applied, whether they would have a statistically significant impact on women who were infertile and increasing their odds. Did I make that up because I wanted those studies to be done, or in fact are they under the way?
Most of them are not under the way. In terms of actual intervention studies, in many cases, it's just not going to be possible to do that, I think, for ethical or practical reasons. For example, if we wanted to go sort of directly test the impact of a multiple vitamin versus a non-multiple vitamin, no ethical review board would allow that because we know, and there are national recommendations, that any woman who even might become pregnant should be on a multiple vitamin that contains folic acid for prevention of neural tube defects. And knowing what we do now about all the health effects of partially hydrogenated fats and trans fats, I don't think we could test that ethically. And for some issues like physical activity and weight control, it's very hard to randomize people and have some people exercise and some not, because not everybody in the exercise group exercises. And a lot of people, if they've heard about the study and get randomized to control, they start exercising because, you know, this can't be bad for me. So very often in those kind of studies, you have almost no contrast between the exercise group and the non-exercise group, or the low-fat diet or the high-fat diet.
Well, and we should end by telling everybody, if you think that you have infertility, if you have been trying to conceive and you have not had success, this book is a wonderful resource, but you should use this as a resource in addition to going to a reproductive endocrinologist to find out what may or may not be going on. And this book and the suggestions in this book should be considered an addition to that, I think.
That's an important point, which we really tried to make clear in our book, too.
Yeah, and you did make it, I thought, very clear. Thank you, Dr. Willett, so much for being my guest today. Dr. Willett's book, he's the co-author, along with two others, of The Fertility Diet. It's available at all bookstores and of course, online. His other book, Eat, Drink, and Be Healthy, The Harvard Medical School Guide to Healthy Eating, is, of course, also worth the read and also available. You have been listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. This show is live every Wednesday from 12 to 1 Eastern Time. You can replay the show or download it as a podcast from iTunes, and you can get both the replay and the podcast from findingyourchild.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast on this page as well. To find out about other shows and to sign up for updates, you go to the homepage of findingyourchild.com and just type in your email address, and I will never share the address with anyone else. Upcoming shows on next week, April 30th, I will be interviewing Dr. Lynn Westfall about egg freezing, who should consider it, and where we are in the technological development of this process. And on May 7th, I will have a show on how to afford adoption, and we'll look at the various options from tax benefits that you might even not know about to grants, loans, and fundraising. And I want to end by reminding you that I have an upcoming series of three shows on the ethical, legal, and emotional issues associated with the various options for disposing of excess frozen embryos. There is a huge number of frozen embryos stored in the United States, well, across the world, but also in the United States. And there really is so little information for people who are trying to decide what their options are, how to go about implementing them, and it's almost the forbidden thing to talk about, the ethical and the legal and the emotional implications of these options. Those shows are coming up starting May 21, May 28, and June 4, and I've got a wonderful experts lined up to help us think through those. According to the CDC, 7.3 million people are infertile. If you are suffering from this disease, you are not alone. There are resources available to help. You can find some of these resources at findingyourchild.com. Thanks for joining us today, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.